Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Imagine trying to make one of those evidence boards about the Trump administration's various investigations. You know, the ones with red string connecting pictures and news headlines, sometimes called a string theory board by law enforcement or called a crazy wall by film nerds? Well, legal analyst and author Jeffrey Toobin manages to collect all those pieces of evidence, testimony, tweets, depositions, news reports in not a nutty or theoretical way, but methodically, and is presented in his new book, True Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump. Since taking office 3.5 years ago, President Donald Trump's former campaign manager, a campaign advisor, his national security advisor, and his personal attorney have gone to jail. Paul Manafort, Roger Stone, Michael Flynn, and Michael Cohen all made headlines when they faced charges as part of Robert Mueller's investigation as a special counsel. Yet Mueller's final report obscured its findings of the president's wrongdoing in dense legal language. In his new book, Toobin chronicles the many people that Mueller's team investigated and the crimes they uncovered, as well as the players on Mueller's team and Mueller himself, who may or may not have been the right man for this job. Toobin also shows why the former FBI's director's determination not to overstep his mandate ultimately hobbled key parts of the investigation. In its review, Publishers Weekly called the book, quote, a definitive behind-the-scenes portrait of what these investigations accomplished and why they didn't bring Trump down. Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer at The New Yorker, as well as CNN's chief legal analyst. Hi, Jeffrey.
Allison, my crazy wall. I like that description.
It must have felt like that at some times. I mean, I was actually very curious. Were you writing this book as this was all happening, or did you one day just wake up and realize somebody needs to connect these pieces of information?
Well, it's somewhere in between. I mean, I agreed with my friends and editors at Doubleday to write a book about the Mueller investigation very shortly after the Mueller investigation started. But I had almost no access to Mueller because of how well they had insulated themselves from the press. They didn't leak. They didn't talk to me. And so I was mostly following it from the outside. But then the story sort of metastasized into the Ukraine story, and it became an impeachment book as well as a criminal investigation book. And I was trying to keep a lot of different balls in the air at the same time, and my goal was always from the beginning was to tell a story, you know, not to, you know, assemble various disparate facts, but try to establish, you know, the chronology and, you know, the human experience of what it's like to investigate a president, whether from a law enforcement perspective, as the Mueller people did, or congressionally, as they did in the House of Representatives.
Well, as we read the book, you clearly see what's happening. Now you clearly see what's happening. But in time, it seems in real time, people weren't exactly putting together these pieces of information. Why do you think it was so hard to see the forest for the trees at the time?
Well, in fairness, this is a complicated story, and mm-hmm. that doesn't mean that it's any less sinister. But it was complicated, and you had these attempts by the Russians to interfere in the 2016 election, very successful attempts, and you had the receptivity of the Trump campaign to those efforts without an actual meeting of the minds between them. And that's a story that is, it's complicated. It's interesting, but it's complicated. And also, from the public's perspective, you know, things came out piecemeal. You know, you learned about the infamous June 2016 election, 2016 meeting in Trump Tower where the Russians, you know, made an offer. You learned mm-hmm. about the hacking of the DNC and the John Podesta emails. But all of that, you know, came out at disparate times. And what I tried to do in the book was to tell it as one story as it unfolded in real time. And I think it makes a lot more sense that way, and is also, frankly, a lot more interesting to read it as a story rather than as sort of disparate newspaper scoops.
My guest, Jeffrey Toobin, the name of his book is True Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump. In your storytelling, we'll get into some details about the cases and the investigations, but in your storytelling, there's so much personal detail. And I'll give people a couple examples and we can talk about why you chose to do this. For example, former White House counsel Don McGahn, who incidentally, kind of in the news today, because he can be forced to testify in front of Congress. The U.S. Court of Appeals in D.C. ruled. But you know he has long hair and he plays in a rock band. And then we learn about Jeanine Rhee, who was on Mueller's team, responsible for two Russian-related indictments, also helped secure the guilty plea for Paul Manafort. But we learn that she loans up on proteins at the buffet because her immigrant parents told her this was the best value. Why do you go into so much detail?
Because people want to know who these people are. I mean, that's you know, one thing I've learned in journalism is that, you know, the question you always get when you say you're covering story A, whether it's O.J. Simpson or Bill Clinton or Robert Mueller, the first question people always ask is, what's he like or what's she like? Mm-hmm. I mean, who are these people? The Mueller investigation was not conducted by a piece of software. I mean, it was people who did this. And it was people, you know, who had to listen to the president of the United States saying that they were a witch hunt and that they were 18 angry Democrats and that they, you know, and what was it like to, you know, not be able even to tell your family what you were working on because Mueller was so worried about leaks? That's why that to me is the story. And the fact that Jeanine Rhee was an immigrant from South Korea and her parents ran not a Korean but a Japanese restaurant, and she was always taught that, you know, on a buffet line you should always eat like the proteins, the meat, you know, don't eat lettuce, don't eat you know, like the vegetables, because you're not getting the right bang for your buck. And I think that tells you a lot about her aggressiveness and seriousness, more than you know, just sort of an abstract description.
So you start the book by pointing out that FBI Director James Comey played a pivotal role for both Trump's election and the Mueller investigation. How did he set the wheels in motion?
I'm sorry, I missed.
How did Comey, you know, Comey is really important to the story.
How did Comey set the wheels in motion?
Yes.
Yes. Well, you know, Comey is a fascinating figure who manages to drive absolutely everyone crazy, Democrats and Republicans alike. I'm sure I don't need to remind the WNYC audience that his, you know, last-minute letter, it was an extremely important factor in getting Donald Trump elected president. But, you know, he, right after the election, even before Trump was inaugurated, he starts to have meetings with Trump and establish a relationship, because the FBI director is supposed to continue for a 10-year term through several, you know, through several presidents. And Comey begins to see that Trump is obviously trying to engage in a corrupt relationship. He is asking for the FBI to be loyal personally to him, not to the rule of law, not to the principles of the FBI, but to be his personal law enforcement authority. And he becomes so uncomfortable that he starts writing up these conversations immediately afterwards, sort of contemporaneous memos about what was said. And eventually, you know, Trump starts asking him to go easy on his friends, particularly Michael Flynn. And he doesn't, you know, he tries to talk his way around it. And ultimately, he's fired on May 9th, 2017. And that really sets the investigation in motion in earnest, in particularly because that was the first of several acts of obstruction of justice that President Trump engaged in.
Comey is... Oh, I had a friend who worked with him in Southern District, and he is very certain of himself, shall we say. Is that a good way to describe? He is very certain?
I would say that, for better or for worse, that's true, yes.
How does, since we're talking about people and their personalities, how does that play into this investigation and what you wrote when you were writing about
it? You know, by the same token that Comey was convinced he had to disclose the continuing investigation of Hillary Clinton on the eve of the 2016 election, he recognized that what Trump was doing was improper. He recognized that the president of the United States should not be telling the FBI director, don't investigate my national security advisor. And Comey did not follow that advice, but he also didn't force a confrontation with the president. And the president, acting as Comey properly recognized, like a mafia don, you know, got rid of him. And, you know, the fact that Comey wouldn't bend to Trump's overtures, I think, speaks very well of Comey. But and that's why Trump has demonized him over the past 3 years, at the same time that Democrats continue to demonize him for his role in the 2016 election. He's a complicated figure. I mean, again, this is one of the reasons I like writing books, is that people are in my experience, are not one thing. They do good things. They do bad things. They do their best under circumstances. Mueller himself is an extremely complicated figure. I like the ambiguity and complexity of people who are not just one thing, and Comey is certainly one of them.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin. The name of the book is True Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump. So Mueller and Trump really, I think they met once, only once, right?
Right, yeah, and that's how my book opens, their one and only meeting in the White House.
And you write about them. The two men, president and prosecutor, were like photo negatives of each other. Trump could not tell the truth, and Mueller could not tell a lie. How did that dynamic affect the Mueller investigation?
Well, I mean, you know, one of the reasons I started with this one and only meeting is because Trump and Mueller have a lot in common. You know, they were born within 2 years of each other, 1942 and 1944. Mueller is 2 years older. They were both born to considerable wealth, as I think we all know about Trump, but Mueller's father was a DuPont executive. They both went to Ivy League schools, Princeton and Penn, but they could not have been more different human beings. Donald Trump has always been about Donald Trump, and Mueller is an institutionalist. Mueller has devoted his lives to institutions that he regards as bigger and more important than he is: the Marine Corps, the Justice Department, the FBI. And as with so many people, I think Mueller's greatest strength also turned out to be his greatest weakness. His devotion to those institutions and his willingness to subordinate his own interests, I think, led him to defer excessively to the Justice Department, especially at the end of the investigation when he let William Barr, the Attorney General, completely distort and mislead the public about what Mueller had actually found, and Mueller never really offered a serious word of protest about that.
Yeah, you get from the sense from your book that Robert Mueller brought a croquet mallet to a paintball fight with Donald Trump.
Well, that, you know, that's I think that's perhaps a little unfair to Mueller. I mean, the quality of his investigation and what he actually found was extraordinary. I mean, the detail of, you know, how the Russians actually influenced the 2016 election was extraordinary. That was the, you know, buffet-going Jeannie Rees work. Mm-hmm. But also the detail and convincingness with which he proved that Trump had engaged in obstruction of justice. But what he didn't do is sort of complete the job. He didn't subpoena the president and force him to testify under oath about what he had done. And he didn't spell out in his report the implications of what he had found. Yes, he described the facts, but he didn't say the president committed a crime. And by not saying that explicitly, he allowed Barr, in his really deeply deceptive effective and politically motivated way to mislead the public about what Mueller actually found.
So you admire Mueller's work more than that's more than I took away from the book. So you do admire his work that he did.
I do. I mean, you know, I think it's important to keep track in the big picture of good guys and bad guys. And Mueller and his team were emphatically the good guys here. But they made mistakes, and they had a difficult job, and they had difficult judgments to make. I think they made some misjudgments. But in terms of their integrity, in terms of their work ethic, in terms of their prosecutorial skill in uncovering facts, I do think they did a good job.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, and the name of his book is True Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump. We'll have more with Jeffrey after a quick break. This is All of It. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest is Jeffrey Toobin. The name of his new book is True Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump. We'll talk about Russia in a minute, but one of the things I really enjoyed in the book, the storytelling part of it, was learning backstories of pieces of information we got in the news that you always wondered, like, I don't really understand what that's about. And what I'm talking about specifically is Rod Rosenstein, Deputy Attorney General, who I didn't realize what a difficult time he had personally and emotionally during this time when he was being asked to find a justification for firing James Comey. You write about how he really started to melt down quite a bit. What happened to him?
Well, you know, again, complicated person, not good, not all good, not all bad. Rod Rosenstein was a political survivor. The only U.S. attorney named by George W. Bush who was kept in office in Baltimore by Barack Obama. And, you know, he was thrust, you know, it's a big deal to be a U.S. attorney in Baltimore, but it's a very different scenario to be thrust into the maelstrom of Washington politics. And literally, in his first week on the job, he is asked to prepare this memo about Comey. He doesn't really understand why. And he prepares a memo that is critical of Comey's performance in the Hillary Clinton investigation. The next day, he discovers, to his horror and outrage, that Sean Spicer, then the White House press secretary, is waving this memo as the justification for why Donald Trump fires James Comey. And Rosenstein is horrified and shocked and embarrassed to be used this way. Mm-hmm. And he recognizes that he is just not being dealt with fairly by the president and the people around him. And it's at that point that he starts meeting with Andrew McCabe, who was the acting director of the FBI after Comey is fired, and he starts spitballing, frankly, these crazy ideas, like, I'll go in and wear a wire on the president, or I'll recruit the cabinet members to invoke the 25th Amendment to get him thrown out of office. Now, Rosenstein has sort of hinted in later conversations that was all just a joke. No, it wasn't a joke. It wasn't entirely serious. I mean, I don't think cooler heads prevailed. He didn't do that. But it horrified him. I mean, it's just indicative of the meltdown. Now, he responded in that meltdown in, I think, a very fair and productive way by, on May 17th, naming Robert Mueller, a very appropriate choice to be the special counsel. So again, you know, it was dumb to write that memo. It was naive, but it was also, I thought, savvy and honorable to name Mueller. It's an example of how people are complicated.
Mueller was determined that this was not going to be a long investigation. Why?
Ken Starr. You know, one of Rob Rosenstein's job earlier in his career was he worked in the Starr investigation. And when Rosenstein hired Mueller, he said, I love Ken Starr, but don't be Ken Starr. Do the investigation and shut it down. And Mueller, that's how Mueller liked to operate. Mueller didn't, you know, the Starr investigation of Whitewater and then the Lewinsky matter took 5 years. The Lawrence Walsh investigation of Iran-Contra took 5 years. Mm. Mueller was not going to spend 5 years, not least because he was 72 when he was appointed. I think that contributed to some of the decisions he made. Most of the time, I think a quick investigation is a good investigation. I don't think law enforcement should take forever. But the failure to subpoena Trump and perhaps a closer call, the decision not to investigate Trump's finances, his tax returns, his possible ties to Russia, was a consequence of Mueller not wanting to spend all those years on the investigation.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, and the name of his book is True Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump. Jeffrey, you write, quote, "The degree of Russian penetration of the Trump campaign in the summer of 2016 can scarcely be overstated." Facebook factors into this, and they sort of did the right thing initially. Facebook's team, how do they help Mueller's team discover how the Internet Russian Agency?
Internet Research Agency.
Research Agency, thank you. How they help the Trump campaign?
Well, you know, there were two really major initiatives that the Russian government engaged in to help Trump in 2016. One was the one you're referring to, the Internet Research Agency, which is a nominally private company, but one that was run by a very close associate of Vladimir Putin in St. Petersburg. And, you know, it was sort of comic what they did, because it wasn't really that big. You know, the Trump and Clinton campaigns spent something like $80 million on Facebook, and the Internet Research Agency spent about $100,000. So it wasn't the money that was so important. But what was interesting is just how much effort they went to and how they learned about American politics and actually set up some rallies in swing states for Trump in the 2016 election. Much more consequential and much more elaborate was the hacking that went on, and the hacking was really done by the Russian government itself, the Russian military intelligence operation. And those hacks, first of the Democratic National Committee emails and then the John Podesta emails, he was Clinton's campaign chair, those were enormously consequential in the narrative of the campaign. And Trump welcomed them. I don't think he initiated it. I don't think he knew what was going on at the time. But the famous line, "Russia, if you're listening, you should continue hacking."
Look for them. Yeah.
Was in fact listened to that very day in July of 2016. And it had a great consequence in the outcome of the election.
As you were going through these, you know, in the book, I want to point out that we're just sort of focusing on the first part, but this book is very long. You show three successes.
I wouldn't say it's very long. It's 490 pages.
It's a great read, but it's 490 pages.
No, it is. It's not a doorstop. It's a little defensive on that subject. I apologize.
You're not Donna Tartt. It's okay.
No, that's right.
But it follows the Mueller investigation to Russian interference, impeachment over the president's actions in Ukraine, and then the outbreak of coronavirus. These all sort of dovetailed and overlapped. And I'm curious, as you looked at the president's tweets and his statements as you wanted to write this book, what patterns did you notice?
Well, you know, first of all, I'd just like to give a shout out to this really remarkable website called Trump Twitter Archive, which keeps track of all of Trump's tweets, and it's easily searchable. And you know, Trump has been tweeting so much and for so long that I think we forget, and they're sort of ignored because that's just Trump. The outrageousness, the lawlessness, the lying, the invective, the coarseness of those tweets, you can hardly even imagine. And, you know, for better or for worse, I forced myself to read all of them. Mm-hmm. And you saw, you know, what really looks like a criminal mind at work, someone who views all of public life, all of government, entirely through the prism of what will help me or hurt me politically. And the corruption and ill intentions revealed by the tweets is really extraordinary, and that continues to this day, including, you know, when COVID was hitting. And at the very beginning, you know, and I was writing about this in February of 2020, this year, and Trump issued 120 tweets, his record, on a day that South Korea recognized that COVID was really a problem and they shut down their government. The fact that Trump was tweeting rather than paying attention to COVID tells you a lot about what's happened subsequently, and that, you know, COVID is not a separate subject from the corruption and incompetence of that I write about in these investigations. The pattern set with Russia and Ukraine continued through COVID with deadly consequences, obviously, mm-hmm. for 160,000 people.
I know this is a hard question, considering how much you had to wade through. But I don't know if you remember that movie, Sliding Doors, with Gwyneth Paltrow. And she gets on one train, and she has one life. And then another version of the movie, she gets on another train car and has another life. Is there a moment you think about through these past 3.5 years, if one thing had happened, not an obvious thing, but if one thing had happened just a little bit differently, that would have had a huge impact?
Gosh, you know, I think the lesson of these past 3.5 years is that the Republican Party has sadly turned itself into a Trump cult. And there is nothing that Robert Mueller could have done. There is nothing that Adam Schiff and the members of Congress could have done that would have allowed the Republicans in the House and the Senate to see what was right in front of their eyes. So, you know, I am critical of Mueller for, you know, not issuing a subpoena, not writing a clear report, but it's not like that would have led to Trump's removal from office, because I think the Republican Party has sold its soul. The Republican Party has decided, unlike the Republican Party in 1974 when Richard Nixon was president and forced out of office, largely because the Republican Party turned on him, this Republican Party is not up to that moral task. And so there is no train that Robert Mueller or anyone else could have gotten on that would have led to a substantially different result.
The name of the book is True Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump. Jeffrey, thank you so much for coming on. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, Allison.